Chapter 12. Ride the Dragon.
We're hell raising and we don't need saving, cause there's no salvation for a bad girl. We're rock bottom, but there ain't no stopping, cause I don't know nothing about love. We're hell raising and we don't need saving, cause there's no salvation for a bad girl. We're rock bottom, but there ain't no stopping, cause it's you and me against the world. I'm a dreamer,
this is real love. Naboo. 12 years ago. 1 week after the liberation of Naboo. It wasn't the first public appearance Padme had made since the occupation had ended, but the press of Hollow News reporters in the receiving room still made her skin crawl, her hands clenching and unclenching beneath the shelter of her voluminous sleeves. She wasn't used to being around this many people anymore, especially in a relatively enclosed space. "Is it time yet?" she murmured to Captain Panaka, who was standing beside the throne. His gaze flicked to the decorative chrono over the fireplace. "Another 10 minutes, Your Majesty." Padme sighed. "Remind me why I'm waiting out here rather than in another room."
"You'd have to take that up with Miss Talon, Your Highness,"
Panaka said. Nexue Talon was her new public relations advisor, currently standing off to the side of the dais and watching the crowd of reporters. According to her, it was important for Padme to be seen even when she wasn't speaking, in order to drown out the naysayers who said that she had lost her guts during the occupation. Panaka had argued about the security risk, but on this occasion, Padme had deferred to Nexue. She still hadn't decided whether that was wise or not, though she was leaning towards the latter, if only out of her own boredom. She looked up as the main door opened, expecting to see more reporters to join the crowd already in the room. Instead, she saw Obi-Wan. He had a blank, shocky expression on his face, and something about the way he was holding himself made the reporters nearest the door back away from him. Padme stood up without even thinking about it, picking up her skirts as she descended the dais. The reporters cleared a path for her without being asked by the royal guard, standing back respectfully as she crossed the room to Obi-Wan. Many of them were muttering excitedly into their recording devices. Some of the blankness in Obi-Wan's eyes faded when he saw her. Padme folded her hands in her skirts to keep from reaching out as she stopped in front of him, looking up at him and trying to divine what had upset him so badly. This close, she could see that his hands were shaking.
"I've left the order."
Her dignity and public image be damned, Padme reached up to pull him into a hug. Obi-Wan's arms went around her, strong and familiar except for the way he was trembling.
"You'll stay?" she asked him.
He nodded.
"I'll stay."
Padme tightened her embrace, wanting to kiss him but knowing that she couldn't do so in front of an audience. In front of their own people, but not strangers. Not when she had to be the Queen of Naboo again, not just Padme. "Master Kenobi, can you tell us why you've resigned from the Jedi?" a reporter chirped.
"I'm going to have that man shot,"
Padme thought, as Obi-Wan pulled away from her. She slipped her hand into his, feeling his fingers close around hers as he looked around for the Hollow News reporter who had spoken.
"He's not a Jedi anymore. I don't care what it looks like."
Had he left the Order for her?
He had said that he wasn't going to.
Obi-Wan's voice was pitched to Carrie, though Padme couldn't identify the emotions in it.
"I disagreed with the Jedi Council on the Senate's intentions for Naboo."
Padme's hand tightened convulsively on his. She looked up at Obi-Wan, willing him to tell her what in blazes that meant without her having to ask. He leaned down and whispered in her ear. She couldn't help her outburst. "They wouldn't dare!"
From Obi-Wan's expression, the Senate not only would dare, but they had every expectation that the Supreme Chancellor would go along with it. The reporters were all murmuring excitedly to each other, clearly on the verge of asking what those intentions were. Padme raised her voice and said, "This press conference will be delayed for..." She glanced at the chrono. "1 hour, while we are briefed on this troubling new development. Please excuse the delay. Refreshments will be provided." Without waiting for a response, she left the receiving room, not releasing her grip on Obi-Wan's hand. They ended up in an empty sitting room, a floor up from the receiving room. Padme pulled Obi-Wan down into a kiss as soon as the door shut behind them, though it immediately slid open again as Panaka, her handmaidens, and Nexue Talon and her staff followed them inside. Obi-Wan kissed her fiercely and quickly, her lip paint smearing across his mouth before he pulled away. He glanced at Padme, waiting for her nod before he spoke. The Galactic Senate, apparently on the advice of Supreme Chancellor Palpatine, has decided against offering humanitarian aid to Naboo, except on the condition that government of this system immediately be turned over to an external committee appointed by the Senate. Under these conditions, Queen Amidala would retain her title, but no formal power, as would the regional and lunar governors and Gungan bosses. But the Royal Advisory Council and all indigenous military installations in the system would be abolished. Republic security forces would be brought in from Coruscant as needed, but Naboo defense forces would be limited to local law enforcement under consideration to be replaced by Republic officials if necessary. Naboo would retain a representative in the Senate, though without voting privileges. The Jedi Order will provide at least 2 knights who will remain on planet for a minimum period of 1 year in order to aid in this transition. There is no projected end date. The Senate made this decision under the claim that Naboo is incapable of simultaneously governing itself and recovering from the Trade Federation occupation, which they're still not admitting actually occurred. Padme sat down on a divan, her hands over her mouth. "That can't be legal," Captain Panaka said, staring at Obi-Wan. "It is. I can name a dozen precedents off the top of my head over the course of the past 2 centuries, and I'm sure there are others I can't remember. In none of those cases did any of those systems. The 12th was the Asumi Trading Company, which used to have Senate standing on par with the Trade Federation and the banking clan, ever regain system sovereignty. Most of them were absorbed by the systems of one or more of the governing committee members. The Asumi Trading Company was bought out by the Trade Federation, and the Iger system descended into civil war and cut ties with the Republic before bombing itself back to the Stone Age." Obi-Wan looked grim. "It's only legal if the system in question agrees. The Senate does not, at this point in time, have the power to depose the lawful government of a sovereign system and install its own government without outstanding circumstances." "How can Chancellor Palpatine support that?" Nexue asked. "Won't he lose his position if Naboo isn't sovereign anymore?" They all looked at Obi-Wan, who shook his head. "That's probably why there's a concession that Naboo could retain a non-voting representative in the Senate. Technically speaking, the senator from Naboo also represents the Chamal sector. But that senator doesn't have to come from Naboo. The system of Naboo would retain a representative without voting rights, while the sector would still have a senator with voting rights. Palpatine can retain his position as chancellor because the sector doesn't lose voting rights. I think, anyway," he added, grimacing. "It's been a while since I had to study political science, and a lot of it went over my head then. Qui-Gon hated politics." "How much aid?" Padme asked, her hands fisted in her lap. "You said that the government aid was conditional. How much?" Panaka's gaze shot towards her. He looked as though he was about to protest. Then he glanced at Obi-Wan for the answer. Obi-Wan shook his head. "I don't know. I've gone on aid missions before, but none military. They were mostly for natural disasters. Two plagues.
He shuddered at the memory.
I wasn't told how much aid the Senate was prepared to offer, or what form that aid would take. It could be a lot. It could be a little. It could be credits. It could be something more substantial, like construction equipment, food, or medical aid. I do know the Jedi whom the Council is going to send to help in the rebuilding. Master Shakti and Master Adigalia and their Padawans.
Not you, Nexue asked.
He shook his head again. I was going back to Coruscant, to be confined in the Jedi Temple, while my suitability for the Order was reassessed. They wouldn't have allowed me to remain on Naboo because I have attachments here that might... that would have compromised my dedication to the Order.
Why did they tell you all this? Panaka asked. If they were already suspicious of you...
Obi-Wan sighed. It was supposed to be reassuring, I think, he said. I expressed concern for the people of Naboo, and the Council was trying to tell me that they would be taken care of by the Senate. I don't think they expected me to protest the Senate's decision, which the Jedi Order is supporting.
I can't be part of that. I won't be part of any institution that supports the dissolution of planetary sovereignty.
Padme looked at him and thought, I love this man. Do you know when the Senate, in the person of Chancellor Palpatine, I suppose, is going to present the offer?
He shrugged.
Tomorrow, maybe? The Council is supposed to be here for another week, but they might want to give you a few days to think about it.
I don't need to think about it, Padme said. Her hands were shaking with fury. I know what my answer is.
Panaka studied her for a moment, his expression concerned, then nodded.
We will support whatever decision you make, Your Highness, he said,
his we encompassing the Planetary Defense Forces and the entirety of Naboo.
Obi-Wan rubbed the back of one hand over his mouth.
I don't know how the Chancellor planned to spring it on you, but the Jedi Council has to have realized that I came straight to you, and that you're now aware of this plot.
What I don't understand, Nexue began, then was interrupted as the door slid open. One of her aides came in, out of breath and carrying a pile of fabric.
Civilian clothes for Master Kenobi, she said.
Obi-Wan looked startled. Padme glanced at Nexue, who nodded at her. She must have sent Kintha for them as soon as Obi-Wan had made his announcement. He was wearing Jedi robes for the first time in nearly a year. He had to change before he appeared in public again.
Right, Obi-Wan said, taking the clothes from Kintha.
He went to a corner of the room to change, all of them politely looking away.
What I don't understand, Nexue said again, picking up the dropped thread of conversation, is why the Senate would want to do this at all. Isn't it just more trouble for them? How can Chancellor Palpatine support this?
I don't know, Obi-Wan said, his voice slightly muffled. I don't even know which senator suggested it, but it was probably one of the Trade Federation's allies. It would be consistent with the historical precedents, unless Naboo has any other enemies.
Panaka cursed. What about Her Highness's response to the Trade Federation? Irte asked, practically, from her position by the door. Does her speech change because of this?
Padme looked at Nexue, who frowned and pulled out her datapad.
Give me a few minutes to look over the text, she said. Unless you have anything you want to add, Your Highness.
I'll wait for your determination first, Padme said.
Obi-Wan, dressed now in gray and dark purple that matched her gown, stars only knew what the reporters would think of that, but it was a nice choice on Kintha's part, came over to sit down beside her, still doing up the last mother-of-pearl buttons on his waistcoat. Padme leaned over to kiss his cheek.
Thank you, she whispered. He put his hand over hers.
I couldn't do it, he whispered back.
I thought I could, but then they told me about this, and I couldn't do it. It isn't right, not after everything that happened here, and even, it just isn't right. The Jedi are supposed to be better than this.
He looked crushed, some of his shock at his decision starting to return now that he had delivered his message.
I thought the Jedi were better than this.
Padme put her arms around him and pulled him down against her, feeling him trembling beneath her hands. She knew that the Jedi Order had been his entire life before Naboo. Until he had come here, he had never known anything else.
His voice shaky, Obi-Wan added quietly. I can't be a Jedi if that's what they are now. I can't live with that.
Padme pressed a kiss to his forehead, her arms tight around him.
They must have offered the Chancellor something to get him to agree, Sabe said. He's Naboo. He'd never...
He might be Naboo, but that doesn't mean anything,
Panaka said.
He was ready to hand Naboo over to the Federation when we were on Coruscant. If he'd ever given a damn about us, he would have raised hell as soon as he was elected.
He wasn't here, Padme said over Obi-Wan's head. He doesn't understand.
Can the Senate force this issue?
Panaka asked Obi-Wan.
Can we appeal it?
Obi-Wan took a deep breath and straightened up, pushing a hand back through his hair.
I don't know, he said. I know that they can't overthrow a lawful government without extreme extenuating circumstances, which I don't think this counts as. My guess is that they're counting on the conditional aid to force Her Highness into accepting without reading the rest of the fine print. I don't think that they're going to budge on some kind of condition. The Trade Federation is still too powerful. We've humiliated them. They need to keep some kind of pride.
Bastards, Sabe muttered.
If they won't even acknowledge the Trade Federation occupation, then how can they do this? Irte asked.
Obi-Wan shook his head. I don't know. Maybe they're arguing that it's a civil war.
Off their looks, he added grimly. I didn't say that it had to make sense. It's the Galactic Senate. It never makes sense.
I don't know what they want, Padme said, but they can't blast it, have it. Naboo's our system.
That got nods and smiles of relief.
Obi-Wan turned towards her, shocky again, and Padme gripped his hand with hers.
You'll always have a place here, she said.
He nodded, and she leaned over to kiss him, her other hand on the side of his face. It was smearing her lip paint, but she didn't care, because Obi-Wan was here, and he was hers, and her planet was free.
Your Majesty, Nexway said, waving the datapad at her. I think only a few minor corrections.
Padme kissed Obi-Wan again, quickly, then turned towards her.
All right, let me see.
When they returned to the receiving room half an hour later, Obi-Wan was with her, half a step behind and to her right.
He was clearly nervous, even more so when he saw the two Jedi standing in the corner of the room, but his step didn't waver.
He took the proper position of a personal bodyguard and advisor, just behind and to the side of the throne, the way he had 100 times before. If he heard the murmurs that followed his reappearance in Naboo somewhere with his lightsaber on his hip, he didn't show it. Padme took her throne, resting her hands on the armrests as she let her gaze travel around the receiving room, lingering for an instant on Adi Gallia and Se-Sitin, who had come in while she had been gone. The Jedi looked back at her impassively, their expressions impossible to interpret. Obi-Wan was disturbingly vague on whether or not Jedi actually could read minds, but for once, Padme hoped that they could.
You can't have Naboo, and you can't have him.
somewhere in the mid-rim, present day.
I heard you did a real number on Ahsoka,
Quinlan said, after the security hatch had closed behind Deepa Balaba. He leaned back against the counter, tucking his thumbs in his belts, and saw Obi-Wan smile.
The truth is never easy, he said,
folding himself into a seat on the end of his cot.
The younger we learn it, the easier it is to come to terms with it.
You, Quinlan said, pointing at him, are a cynic, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Just a realist.
For a moment, he looked concerned.
Is Plo Koon angry with me?
You're lucky she's Master Plo's Padawan and not Windu's or Shakti's, Quinlan said. But Master Plo trained with the Baran, though, not just the Order, so he told me to tell you that he appreciates you giving Ahsoka the lesson. The Order is... He hesitated, searching for the right words, and saw Obi-Wan's eyes narrow as he waited for a response.
It isn't the same Order that you left 13 years ago, he said finally.
Obi-Wan let his gaze flicker around his cell.
You don't say.
Not like that, Quinlan said. He glanced up at the security holocam in the corner of the room, but if he fuzzed it now, he'd have half a dozen Jedi running in here with their lightsabers blazing within a minute. Neither he nor Obi-Wan would appreciate that. After Master Jin was killed and Yuan Dooku resigned, the Order got more insular. Palpatine and the Senate tied our hands as far as official missions went, so we started working a lot more missions beneath the radar. Shadow work.
I remember the jargon, Obi-Wan said. Thulm's division. Didn't I hear that someone in the Senate proposed an investigation into the internal workings of the Order about 9 years ago?
You heard right. It didn't get far, but it got farther than anyone expected. Quinlan frowned. The Council doesn't like losing people, Obi-Wan. Jedi don't resign more than once or twice a century, and never two in the same week. Dooku made his reasons pretty clear, but you didn't, and that scared them. If you'd just said you left for Amidala, I didn't. They would have understood that. They wouldn't have liked it, but they would have understood it. As it was, you had them jumping at shadows, especially after you dropped your bombshell about the Sith.
Obi-Wan's mouth tightened into a thin line. If they'd believed me the first time, we wouldn't be having this conversation, he said.
Maybe not, Quinlan allowed. But here we are. It's a hard thing to believe, Obi-Wan, even for the Jedi. Everyone in the Order has been chasing shadows ever since, but we haven't come up with anything aside from some feral kid in the Outer Rim. And you. You can see our problem.
I don't have time to try and take over the galaxy, Obi-Wan said dryly. I'm a bit busy with other matters.
Any chance, Quinlan began, because he had to try. Obi-Wan's momentary amusement warmed the Force.
No, I am not going to tell you what they are. There's exactly one thing I'll talk to the Jedi freely about, and that's the return of the Sith. But it was a nice try, Quinn.
Quinlan grinned back.
I'll catch you up sometime, Obi-Wan. You can try.
Obi-Wan pushed a hand back through his hair.
What were you saying about the Order, Quinn?
I'm starting to wonder which one of us is running this interrogation, Quinlan observed.
Interrogation? Obi-Wan said, his eyebrows arching delicately. I thought we were just two old friends having a conversation. How disappointing.
You're lucky I'm willing to admit I'm your friend, Obi-Wan, Quinlan said. He looked around, found the chair he had sat in the last time he'd been on guard duty, and brought it over. Only after he had gotten both it and himself arranged to his liking did he start talking again.
You remember when we were younglings? The Order used to do cross-training with a couple of other Force disciplines in the Republic. That's why Master Plo is a Baran Dos sage, as well as a Jedi Master. The Order was all right with letting him go to Doran to train after he passed his trials. Same with me and my guardian training on Kifu, or Deepa Balaba and the Chalakdan Adepts,
even Windu and the Koronai. They don't allow knights and padawans to do that anymore. You're either Jedi, or you're not. Quinlan tugged thoughtfully on one of his dreadlocks, watching Obi-Wan. Younglings like Ahsoka, even Aayla, they don't really consider anything outside the Order. When you and I were Padawans, at least we knew that there was something else out there. We might have thought we were the best damn thing in the galaxy, but at least we knew it wasn't us versus the rest of the galaxy. The problem is that that's not how the Order thinks now. There's the Jedi, and then there's everyone else. No middle ground, no shades of gray, just light and dark.
And I complicate that, Obi-Wan said slowly. I'm not a Jedi, but I'm not anything else either. And unlike Chancellor Dooku, I'm not under the Order's eye.
That's probably a big part of it, Quinlan admitted. It's not everything, but it doesn't help that you were cloistered away on Naboo for years, even before Pantora and the Separatist Crisis.
And there's that, Obi-Wan said, with bitter amusement. 5,000 years, and by now you'd think the Order would know better.
I remember my history, Quinlan. I know that this sort of thing comes around every few centuries or so. I just wish that this century wasn't one of those.
You and me both, brother,
Quinlan said. He rested his arms on the back of the chair he was straddling, considering Obi-Wan's calm expression. He didn't know if he would have been able to manage that level of calm if their positions had been reversed, but Obi-Wan always had been a better Jedi than he was. Right up until he wasn't anymore.
I suppose I can't hope for much support from anyone in the Order, Obi-Wan added, more quietly.
For a moment, Quinlan felt something that might have been fear shiver in the Force. Then it was gone, and Obi-Wan just looked tired. The fading bruises from his beating at the hands of the Federation's goons stood out starkly against his skin.
He probably should have kept his mouth shut, but Obi-Wan deserved to know what he was walking into.
That depends. On? On whether or not Master Yoda wakes up before we get back, and on what he has to say when he does.
Obi-Wan nodded to himself, apparently unsurprised.
I didn't have anything to do with that, you know.
Quinlan shrugged.
I know it's not your style. You prefer to do your own dirty work.
You know I'm not going to confirm or deny that, Obi-Wan remarked.
Force forbid I accidentally give the Council something they could actually use against me, instead of just rumors, lies, and Republic propaganda.
Are you kidding? If it wasn't for rumors, lies, and Republic propaganda, we might be out of a job, Quinlan said, just to see Obi-Wan smile.
You're not the only one the Order's been chasing, you know, just the biggest name. We've been running down ferals for the past couple of years, too, even though most of them couldn't so much as levitate a feather if their lives depended on it. The only one that has half a chance of being a threat is some kid that Eve Koth ran into on Christophsis a couple of years ago, and he's completely harmless, even if he did manage to get the drop on Master Koth long enough to get away.
Obi-Wan looked interested.
A feral? A teenager. Well, he was a teenager then. If he's still alive, he'd be in his early 20s. Strong in the Force, but completely self-trained. I actually know the kid. I met him on Tatooine when Aayla and I were on a deep cover mission 13 years ago. He's no more Sith than you or I are.
Quinlan shook his head, scowling. But that tells you how paranoid the Order's gotten recently. Annie Skywalker uses the Force to win card games and impress girls. He's not a threat except in the High Council's fevered nightmares. But there's a killer capture order on him in Republic space anyway.
Skywalker? You know him?
Obi-Wan shut his eyes. Quinlan felt the Force tremble. But the tremor didn't seem to come from Obi-Wan. It just was. As though the Force itself was trying to tell them something.
No, Obi-Wan said at last, opening his eyes. I don't know him, but I feel like I should somehow. Maybe in another life we were friends.
Or enemies, Quinlan said, raising his eyebrows. He'd heard about things like that before, though it was up there with the rest of the Jedi fairy tales, like the knight in the stasis pod.
Obi-Wan frowned. Maybe both, he said.
It doesn't matter now, since I doubt we'll ever meet in this life.
Then he stopped abruptly, surprise passing over his face. Quinlan felt the Force shiver again, but it was only the echoes of whatever Obi-Wan had sensed, not something he could interpret.
Obi-Wan?
It's nothing.
Obi-Wan's wild talent was precognition, just like Quinlan's was psychometry. If he had sensed something, then it in all likelihood wasn't nothing. But the chances he'd let slip what it had been were minuscule.
Quinlan frowned at him a moment more, watching Obi-Wan's gaze slide away from his.
They both glanced up as a chime sounded over the comm systems, which was hooked into Resolute's as long as Paladin was in her hangar bay.
All personnel, prepare to exit hyperspace at time 1-5. Be prepared for combat immediately upon arrival.
Obi-Wan's eyes narrowed, his hope flaring briefly in the Force. It was the same announcement they'd gotten a dozen times since leaving the Naboo system, jumping in and out of systems that their records said were friendly to the Republic. So far, the records had been right, but it was only a matter of time until they jumped into a system that had gone over to the Confederacy, where it was otherwise hostile to the Republic.
I don't suppose there's any point in asking where we are, Obi-Wan said.
Still in the Midrim, Quinlan said. I can't remember which system we're about to jump into.
Obi-Wan nodded to himself, presumably running out the number and length of the jumps they had made since leaving Naboo, in an attempt to calculate the route they were taking back to Coruscant.
10 years ago, they could have done it in a little over a day, in almost a straight shot. As it was, they had to keep jumping in and out of hyperspace to make minor recalculations that would avoid transit through hostile systems, or systems that would protest the presence of a fleet of Republic warships.
Lorican, Obi-Wan said abruptly.
Quinlan blinked at him.
What?
We're about to jump into the Lorican system, aren't we?
Or Zarabashka, but I don't think we were in hyperspace long enough for that during the third jump.
I could be wrong, though.
Oh, in blazes! He felt a grin tuck at his mouth.
You can take the boy out of the Jedi, but you can't take the Jedi out of the boy.
Training and experience, Obi-Wan said. Qui-Gon used to make me run out blind jumps without a Navic computer. I know the Midrim better than most Jedi ever will.
Thul made me do the same thing, but I couldn't have pulled that one off, Quinlan admitted.
Lorican, Obi-Wan said thoughtfully. We'll be in Gaius next, won't we?
Something about the way he said that made Quinlan look at him sharply.
What makes you think we're not going to Sahil Ali instead?
The star's completely unstable. You can't make a safe hyperspace jump into that system. Well, you might be able to jump in, but you'd never be able to jump back out again.
You might be able to make Estrin, but the Alliance mined that hyperlane. They'll read the Republic tags on your Star Destroyers and pull you out of hyperspace.
Us, Quinlan said. You're on one of those Star Destroyers, too.
Obi-Wan smiled.
There is that.
He shifted his position slightly, rubbing at his shoulder.
How long until we reach Coruscant?
Sooner than you think, Quinlan said, feeling his mouth tighten.
Exiting hyperspace. All personnel prepare for immediate combat upon entry to real space.
The bottom of his stomach dropped as Resolute re-entered real space. Quinlan couldn't sense any danger, but he held his breath anyway until the all-clear came over the comms. There hadn't been a Confederate fleet waiting for them to drop out of hyperspace.
Obi-Wan huffed out of breath, sounding tired, and ran a hand through his hair.
Better luck next time, Kenobi,
Quinlan said, as the captain of the Resolute informed them that they would make the jump to light speed in 5 hours. Some of the Federation warships had been too badly damaged at Naboo to make flash jumps in and out of hyperspace without any recovery time.
I can only hope, Obi-Wan said. The only problem is, Quinlan said, feeling Paladin's engines hum to life beneath his feet.
There isn't going to be a next time.
Obi-Wan shut his eyes.
The Jedi are leaving the fleet, he said.
Quinlan had expected him to sound defiant or angry, anything. But instead, Obi-Wan just sounded resigned.
Without the fleet, we can make a more or less straight run back to Coruscant, Quinlan said. The Council made the call.
Shakti's voice came over the comms, informing them that Paladin would be leaving Resolute's secondary hangar momentarily. Obi-Wan bowed his head, twisting his wedding ring around his finger.
Bail Organa and Nuke Gunray?
Not Jedi business, Quinlan told him. You are, Obi-Wan. I'm sorry, the Council insisted.
Of course they did.
He couldn't hide his frown at the sharp note in Obi-Wan's voice.
Look, he said. Once you're there, the Council will realize you're not Sith. They'll...
What, Quinn? What are they going to do?
You just told me that the Council isn't going to listen to anything I say.
His expression was bleak.
And even if they do come to the conclusion that I haven't done any of the things they've accused me of, they're not going to let me go. I'm a general in the Confederate Army, Quinn, and Queen Amidala's husband besides that. The Senate will make a very public example of me.
What do you want me to say, Obi-Wan? I have a duty, too. I can't do anything about it.
I know that, Obi-Wan snapped. I don't expect you to do anything, Quinlan. I know better than to expect anything from the Jedi.
He touched a finger to his wedding ring again, and added quietly,
My wife is pregnant. I was hoping to live long enough to see my child born.
Obi-Wan,
either the Jedi will kill me or the Senate will, Obi-Wan said. Don't fool yourself about why you're taking me to Coruscant. The Republic will kill me. Then the Confederacy or the Alliance or even the Jedi will kill Queen Amidala. Grant me the dignity of not lying to me about what's going to happen.
I'm sorry, Quinlan said, feeling helpless. Obi-Wan hesitated for a long minute.
I know, he said at last. But that doesn't change anything, and I won't make my wife any less of a widow.
Quinlan looked down. The humming of the engine increased as Paladin's propulsion units kicked in.
He couldn't quite feel the cruiser lifting off, but he imagined he did.
5 minutes until we make the jump to light speed, Shakti announced over the comms system.
Obi-Wan bowed his head, his lips moving silently, but Quinlan couldn't tell if he was praying or cursing.
Obi-Wan, he said at last, I'll make sure you get a fair trial.
Obi-Wan glanced up at him.
You can't, he said, but I appreciate the offer.
After Nuke Gunray's ill-conceived attack on Naboo, events began moving much more quickly than either Dooku or Amidala anticipated. Less than 2 days after the bombardment, with civilians still trapped in the rubble of Theed and the Naboo planetary defense grid in tatters, a flotilla of 40 warships broke off from the Naboo Second Fleet and took off for the Serenna system, home of Supreme Chancellor Dooku. Much digital ink has been spent on debating whether Strike Group 5, as the flotilla was officially designated, was sent on a retaliatory mission by Queen Amidala, or whether Commodore Celador Nanda independently made the rather dramatic decision to attack Sereno. A number of transmissions from the days immediately following the bombardment still remain classified by the Special Operations Bureau, but what is known
is that within hours of Strike Group 5's departure, Amidala called a meeting of all flag and general officers in the Naboo Planetary Defense Forces. One of the matters under discussion was retaliation against the Republic and the Trade Federation. Rash decisions were certainly in Commodore Nanda's character. At the age of 32, Celador Nanda was, like many of Naboo's flag and general officers, young for her position, part of the generation that had come too quickly to adulthood under the occupation. 13 years earlier, she had been a cadet in the Royal Security Forces Academy at Parley. When Trade Federation forces occupied the planet, she, along with the other cadets at RSFA Parley, were incarcerated at Internment Center 953 TR5 in the Terra Saloon Hills. Nanda and the other internees spent almost 6 months doing hard labor in IC-953 TR-5 before they were liberated by Obi-Wan Kenobi and a strike team from Theed. Nanda, along with many of the cadets that would later become her fellow fleet and army officers, joined the Naboo resistance upon their arrival in the capital. Like most of her generation, which included both Amidala and Kenobi, she bore a deep and lasting resentment towards the Trade Federation and the Republic, and was an outspoken proponent of retaliatory action against both for their parts in the occupation. After the liberation of Naboo, Nanda returned to RSFA Parley, and 3 years later was commissioned as an officer in the Royal Naboo Security Forces. Brilliant, vivacious, and talented, she volunteered for the newly created Naboo Home Fleet, serving as a junior officer on the Battlestar Constellation during the Pantoran Crisis, before becoming captain of the light cruiser Resolve. On Constellation, and later on Resolve, the destroyer Integrity, and the heavy cruiser Fearless, she served in all of Naboo's major engagements before the declaration of planetary sovereignty. Shortly after the formation of the Confederacy of Independent Systems, she was given command of the Battlestar Intrepid and promoted to captain. Her promotion to Commodore 2 years later came along with command of Strike Group 5, which, although technically under the command of Admiral Nico Hamilcar, often operated independently of the Second Fleet. In the wake of the Second Battle of Naboo, news of the attack spread quickly through the myriad and cosmographically diverse systems of the Confederacy. Amidala's broadcast to the people of Naboo meant only to be a holdover until more information about the attack could be gathered, was transmitted over the Confederate holonet. Within 42 hours, every member of the Naboo armed forces serving abroad had heard about the attack on their home system. Reprisal was the word on everyone's lips, and questions about retaliation were flying fast and furious between Naboo and the commanding officers of the 1st and 2nd Fleets and their associated strike groups. Scarcely less urgent were the transmissions from other planetary leaders, delegates to the Confederate Congress, and non-Naboo military officers. Amidala was being pressured on all sides to act and act quickly, and preferably bloodily. In this context, Strike Group 5's departure from the Second Fleet makes sense. The slowest ship in Strike Group 5 was Intrepid herself, and the Battlestar was the fastest of her generation, able to keep up with the heavy cruiser squadron, if not the destroyers and light cruisers at full speed. Nanda was used to commanding fast fleet actions and blitzkrieg attacks against orbital stations and planetary establishments, though it was for defense of a civilian convoy that she received her final promotion to Commodore. At 32 years old, when officers in most other space navies were still years away from their first commands, she was the 7th highest-ranking officer in the Royal Naboo Navy, which was distinguished for the youth of its officers. With Emil Agathon and Yvonne de Loca with the Home Fleet, Gina Rioni and Jamie Asuna with the First Fleet, Yule Catherine Dock, and Nico Hamilcar commanding the Second Fleet, Celador Nanda was the rational choice to command a blitz attack on the Supreme Chancellor's home planet. She was a personal friend of Queen Amidala and Obi-Wan Kenobi, both of whom preferred assigning dangerous missions to those they knew and trusted. Her loyalty to Amidala was exceptional, even among the Naboo officer corps, the majority of whom had worked directly with the Queen during and immediately following the occupation. Although absolutely ruthless, especially when faced with Commerce Guild warships, she was no more so than other survivors of the Federation occupation. The suggestion that she might have gone rogue and taken matters into her own hands seems absurd at best, slanderous at worst. After all military and industrial targets on Sereno had been reduced to smoking craters and Strike Group 5 had rejoined the Second Fleet, Queen Amidala claimed responsibility for the Blitzkrieg attack. Yet the orders, though signed by the Queen, are suspiciously post-stated. The digital trail leading to the hours after the flotilla left the fleet, rather than those before it. Moreover, not all the ships assigned to Strike Group 5 accompanied Intrepid, while the 8th Heavy Cruiser Squadron left its assigned position in the 2nd Fleet to join the flotilla. Post-dated orders excuse this discrepancy by rearranging the flotilla's makeup, but most damning are the scattering of escort warships that joined Strike Group 5 without the accompaniment of their squadrons. Although the content itself has been scrubbed, timestamps from the message traffic and captured 2nd Fleet warships suggest that transmissions were flying fast and heavy not only between Admiral Hamilcar's flagship Steadfast and Intrepid, but also between individual ships in the fleet, including broadcasts from both Steadfast and Intrepid to the fleet. It is easy to imagine the chaos that must have occurred after the 2nd Fleet, light years away from their homeworld, heard about the attack on Naboo. First the official announcement by Admiral Hamilcar, who addressed the fleet personally, then the holonews coverage in Queen Amidala's broadcast. Tempers were running high. Nearly all of the Naboo personnel had friends or family still living in the system, and even those members of the fleet who didn't hail from Naboo were hollering for blood. Hamilcar's assertions that they would get it sooner rather than later must not have been enough for Nanda, who had a long history of rash actions that usually fell just under the letter of her orders, if not quite in the spirit. For Amidala and Kenobi, the former was usually enough. Either alone or in conjunction with the captains under her command, Nanda made the decision to retaliate against the Galactic Republic for their attack on Naboo. Whether or not she knew that the Trade Federation had acted without the blessing of the Galactic Senate was inconsequential. The Republic had attacked her homeworld. She was going to return the favor. With Kaida Nemoidia and Coruscant out of easy reach, she took the next best, and most powerfully symbolic, option. Sereno, homeworld of Supreme Chancellor Dooku. Trapani, I. Torn Asunder, A History of the Great Galactic War, Volume 2. Coruscant, University of Coruscant Press.
Amidala wiped away the brave face she had been putting on all day, along with the last of her face paint, slumping back in her chair as her handmaidens began to take down her hair. "Those idiots," she said. "Those brave, bloody idiots." "You couldn't have made any other decision, my lady," Thorme said, setting aside the large crescent-shaped headpiece and starting in on the side pieces. Her expression desultory, Amidala reached up to remove her earrings and put them down on the vanity next to the headpiece. "I know. That's why Celador isn't on her way back here for a court-martial right now. But she'll never be promoted again." "I don't believe I know Commodore Nanda," Padme said. She was standing by the door to the Queen's dressing room, looking around while Dorme and Rabe helped Amidala undress. She had offered to help, but Amidala had waved her off. Neither her gown nor her hair was elaborate enough to require three people. "Celador is a friend," Amidala said after a moment. "Normally her aggressiveness is an asset. She is a very good commander under most circumstances." "As long as the circumstances require her to blow up ships," Rabe said under her breath. Dorme rolled her eyes. "That's not fair. She likes blowing up buildings, too." "I said most circumstances," Amidala said dryly. "Still, I didn't expect this from Celador. A few of the others, maybe, but not her." She pinched the bridge of her nose between her fingers, looking tired. "At least Chairman Chicho won't be able to claim that I'm insufficiently aggressive anymore." They had received confirmation of Strike Group 5's attack on Sereno 2 hours ago. Amidala had taken it better than Padme probably would have under the same circumstances, receiving the news with stony-faced silence. She must have made the decision to accept responsibility for the attack while they were still waiting to hear if Amidala's worst fears had come to pass, though she hadn't put the orders into the Naboo Milnet until Commodore Nanda had reported complete success. "He'll complain that you didn't wait for the Congress to vote on it first," Rabe pointed out, laying down one of the side headpieces next to the larger piece, and taking a moment to straighten out the chains dangling from it. He can complain all he wants. They were my forces and under my command. And even if they weren't, the Articles of Confederation make the President the Commander-in-Chief of the Confederate Armed Forces, Amidala said. I don't need the Congress's permission for a little thing like that. At least Palpatine was good for one thing. I never thought I'd be glad for that part. She passed a hand over her face, her expression exhausted. I need a drink. No, Dorme said firmly. Amidala sighed, flattening one hand against her stomach. Padme hesitated, then gave in to curiosity and asked, How far along are you? She saw the flash of the Queen's quick smile in the vanity's mirror. 10 weeks, she said. Not very far. You're first? The expression on Amidala's face made her wish she hadn't asked. But the Queen's voice was even, as she said. I had a miscarriage after the Trade Federation bombed my third coronation 6 years ago. Oh, Padme said, stricken. I didn't know. I'm sorry. Amidala bowed her head. Rabe's expression was stony as she set the second side piece down, but Dorme's face was turned away. It's all right. It's past now, anyway. I'm still sorry. That's a dreadful thing to happen to anyone. Thank you. Amidala's hand was still resting on her stomach. Do you have children? She asked after a moment. No, Padme said, then corrected herself. Not yet. Someday, I hope. She liked children. Anakin liked children. They hadn't talked about it much, but she knew that Anakin had planned to leave the Order after the war ended. After that, she could step down from her position in the Senate, and they could live together openly as husband and wife, as something normal. But none of that was possible now. Too much had changed since the last time she and Anakin had been together before Odrim, for her to even know if that was what she wanted anymore. She had been quiet for too long, she realized, looking up to see Amidala regarding her thoughtfully. After a moment, the Queen smiled at her, the expression tired but sweet. May both of us get what we want, then. Padme found herself smiling back. That would be nice. Unlikely, Amidala allowed, twisting her wedding ring around on her finger. But nice. She tipped her head forward as Dorme pressed gently on the back of her skull, to work a handful of braids free, dropping pin after pin on the vanity. It seems mad to me, you know. I can't imagine a world where all of this... She flicked one hand sideways to encompass the past 13 years. Never happened. I still can't get my head around a world where it did, Padme said slowly. Except she could. Just the edges of it. Because the days surrounding the invasion of Naboo stood out clearly in her memory. She wondered if this was how the Jedi remembered things, able to reach back into the depths of their own past, to pick out a single event and relive it. It is clear to me now that the Republic no longer functions. If they hadn't been able to break the siege, hadn't been able to recover Naboo, would she have come to believe that, in truth? Would Obi-Wan? A week ago, she would have said, no, never. Now? She still didn't know if she could contain Amidala's simmering rage, her casual viciousness, or her clear hatred for the Galactic Senate, all of it built over 13 years of events Padme couldn't pretend to understand. But 13 years ago, she might have. Would have. There was a photographer with us. Amidala said. The words didn't make any sense at first, and Padme blinked at her. What? During the siege. Nexue Talon. Do you know her? She's my public relations advisor. We took photographs. They're on the holonet. You can access them from the display in your room.
It might help you understand.
Padme nodded slowly. I'll look at them, she said. And since Amidala seemed to be amenable, if not necessarily in what Padme would have called a good mood, she added, Anakin and Obi-Wan can help with the recovery in the city, you know. They'd like to. They've done it before.
Amidala's mouth tightened at their names. Theed isn't a safe place for Jedi,
was all she said before the door chime sounded.
She winced and massaged her forehead with her fingertips. I'm not available unless something is on fire.
I'll tell whoever it is, Padme said. Since Rabe and Dorme had their hands full with the heavy weight of the Queen's hair, now being painstakingly taken out of its many small braids.
Amidala looked relieved. Thank you.
Padme slipped out of the dressing room and made her way through the quiet, empty rooms of the royal suite to the main door. Moon and starlight poured in through the open windows. There was still smoke in the air, but the smell was less prominent than it had been this morning. All of the Queen's other handmaidens had retired for the evening, leaving Padme and the three women in the dressing room the only occupants of the royal suite. She could feel the emptiness of the space echoing around her, noticing now, as she hadn't earlier, the small, telltale indications scattered around of a second resident in a way her own apartments back in Coruscant couldn't boast. It wasn't common for a monarch to be married, but it did happen from time to time. Her step was light on the lushly carpeted floor. Padme crossed to the door, distracted by her conversation with the Queen, and touched the control. She marshaled her face into an expression of polite indifference as it slid open. I'm sorry, Her Majesty isn't—
Oh, Your Highness, Palpatine said, as if she hadn't spoken. How wonderful!
Padme couldn't help her recoil, jerking back from him as her hands closed into fists. Her voice leapt an octave as she said, Congressman Palpatine, the Queen isn't available for visitors now. It's very late. She couldn't have managed Amidala's cool disdain if her life had depended on it, and maybe it was that which made Palpatine peer at her and frown.
Am I not addressing Her Royal Highness? He said slowly.
Padme froze.
No, I'm...
She said the first name that came to mind.
Leia. Are you?
Palpatine's voice was soft. Something in his face changed, something that made him almost unrecognizable as the man Padme had known on Coruscant, no longer the kind, grandfatherly politician he had been playing at on the Boo. When he spoke again, the timbre of his voice was different.
Who are you?
Maybe it was the Ouroboros in her pocket. Maybe it was her experience with Jedi. But Padme could actually feel him pushing at her mind. Padme couldn't help taking a step back, raising her hand as if to ward off the assault on her mind, on her spirit.
My name is Leia, she said again, hearing her voice shake.
The pressure shoved at her, trying to twist her words into something else, into the truth.
You want to tell me who you really are?
I'm one of Her Royal Highness's handmaidens. Palpatine stepped towards her, and Padme, shivering violently, fell back from him.
Tell me what you are.
Padme clapped a hand to her mouth, knowing that if she spoke, she'd blurt out the truth. She had asked Anakin once to practice mental compulsion on her until she learned to resist it, but he had refused, apparently horrified at the thought. Now she wished that she had insisted, or made Obi-Wan do it instead.
What are you? Palpatine demanded. You will tell me, or you will live to regret it.
She could feel the power in the air, the way she had with Obi-Wan when he had nearly lost control this morning, or with Anakin when he had used the Ouroboros to transport them out of the collapsing Senate building. But that had felt clean, had at least seemed natural, while this fell over her skin like a sticky web, clinging as she tried in vain to twist herself free of it.
A Jedi might have managed it, but Padme wasn't a Jedi. She was only human, and she could feel it threatening to drag her down and destroy her. There was nothing she could do to resist it.
"You are not the Queen of Naboo," said Palpatine.
Said Darth Sidious, because that was who he was, really was. And finally Padme understood that in a way she never had before, even when he was dying under her hands and taking the whole galaxy with him.
"You are not her handmaiden. You will tell me what you are and how you came to be here."
The pressure was unbearable. Padme choked out a scream against her hands, a scream that started to turn into words. "Padme Nabari Amidala, Senator from Naboo, former Queen of Naboo, member of the Galactic Senate," before she bit down hard enough on her lip that she tasted blood. Palpatine moved towards her, backing her into the antechamber. He seemed to grow in stature with every step, darkness spreading behind him until Padme couldn't see the wall or the open door or anything except him. "Congressman Palpatine!"
Rabi's voice was like a whiplash. It cut through the cloud of darkness as Palpatine shrank back into himself, pulling the shadows into his skin again and rearranging his features so that he was nothing more than a man. Padme took two rapid steps away from him and almost fell over a couch when she ran into it. Instead, she clung to the padded back, trembling uncontrollably, and did her best to resist the urge to be violently ill.
Rabe stalked across the room towards Palpatine, as if he had done her a personal wrong. She didn't spare a glance for Padme, but instead said coolly, "Her Highness is very tired. I'm afraid she isn't accepting visitors this evening."
Palpatine smiled beneficently at her, which only made Rabe's glower deepen.
Rabe would never make a politician, but she made a very good bodyguard.
"Of course, my dear," Palpatine said. "In her condition, the Queen needs all the rest she can get, especially in such trying times as these. I merely wanted to congratulate Her Royal Highness on the success of the bombardment on Serrano. Such a strong reprisal attack will surely make the Republic think twice about challenging the Confederacy again."
"I will convey your words to Her Majesty," Rabe said coolly. "Good night, Congressman Palpatine."
Inclining his head slightly, Palpatine turned and left.
The moment the door closed behind him, Rabe crossed to Padme, catching her shoulders in her strong hands.
"Sit down," she said firmly, and Padme managed to get her legs to cooperate, though she collapsed more than sat.
"What did he do to you?" Rabe asked, sitting down beside her. She put an arm around Padme's shoulders, all her earlier hostility gone, and Padme let herself lean against her. Rabe had left her services after she had finished her last term as queen, but they were still friends, and Padme could remember 100 times they had sat exactly like this.
"You're bleeding. Did he strike you?"
Padme touched her fingers to her lip, the motion clumsy, and stared in dull surprise at the bright red smeared across her fingers. She couldn't remember doing that. Everything felt muted and dull, as if she was swimming through mud. Rabe's voice seemed to be coming from very far away, fading in and out of focus. She tried to stand up again.
I need to tell...
Padme! Rabe laid a hand on her wrist.
"What happened? Tell me, it's all right."
"It wasn't all right. It would never be all right, not so long as Palpatine was breathing."
"You should kill him," she said, her words seeming to blur on her tongue. She saw, as if in a vision. Was this how the Jedi saw the future?
Amidala, dead on the floor of a throne room, her handmaiden sprawled around, the marble floor turned red with blood. Outside the windows, war raged in the streets and skies of Theed. She was struck by how much she wanted the Queen to live,
proud, beautiful, vicious Padme Amidala, who should have been everything that Padme had spent most of her life trying not to be.
"You have to kill him," she said again. "She'll never be safe until he's dead."
"Palpatine?" Rabe said, surprised. "He's harmless." Padme started to laugh, but it turned into a sob.
"You have no idea," she said. "None of us did."
She blundered away from Rabe, ignoring the handmaiden's outstretched hand, and found the control for the door.
I have to go," she said, the words meaningless and nonsensical to her ears. I have to go.
"Padme!" She picked up her skirts and ran. Afterwards, she wasn't sure how she managed to get from the royal suite to their guest chambers. She burst past the startled guards and into the sitting room, straight into Anakin. She hit him hard enough that he let out a oof of surprise and staggered backwards, though he didn't fall down. Instead, he put his arms around her, and Padme put her face against his familiar chest and wept, the tears streaming helplessly down her face.
"Padme?"
That was Obi-Wan's voice, somewhere behind Anakin.
"What happened?"
"Padme, who hurt you?" Anakin demanded. "Tell me, I'll rip his blasted head off, I swear I'll—"
But by then, she couldn't remember anymore.